It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're talking about absentee ballots and the latest decision by the Wisconsin Elections Commission. So the commission decided this week not to require local clerks to send two ballots to people who want to vote absentee in the April 7th presidential primary. This is a reversal from earlier this month when local clerks were instructed to send two ballots in order to comply with different deadlines. What questions do you have about voting absentee? Why are you voting absentee this year? Have you done so in the past? We're at 800-642-1234. Riley Vedderkind is a government and politics reporter for the Wisconsin State Journal. Riley, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me.
So step back for us. Where did these two ballots come from, and what were we looking at leading into the decision this week not to do two ballots?
So the decision to do this originally came from the fact that the state has a law on the books. It's been on the books since 2011, actually, that for races that involve both a federal race, so in this case it would have been the presidential primary, and then a statewide race, for the April 7th election is the Wisconsin Supreme Court election, as well as other state and local races in some cases. The law requires, state law requires, that the local elections clerks send out absentee ballots to voters who request them 47 days before the date of the election. So this year, that would have been February 20th for the April 7th presidential primary and Wisconsin Supreme Court race, which fall on the same date. And so the plan was to send out two ballots to those voters. It would have been at least about 81,000 people because they needed to comply with the law. So the plan was to send out an A ballot, what they called it, earlier to voters, which would only include the presidential primary race in order to comply with the law that these voters get that ballot within 47 days. They weren't able to put the whole races on it, which would have been also, you know, not only the presidential primary, but also the state Supreme Court race and other races, because the date is February 20th that they would need to have sent it out, which is only 2 days after the February 18th primary election, which is coming up next week. And that 2 days for a local elections clerks is just simply not enough time to be able to certify the elections and just make sure that they have the right candidates on the ballot. So they could have done it for the presidential primary because those candidates were decided earlier this year. However, they would not have been able to have the entire set of races on the ballot. So they needed to send out a B ballot later, which would have had both the presidential and then the correct winners from the primary race next week, and that would be sent out in a second ballot, and then voters would need to return that second ballot or both ballots. But if they only returned the A ballot, then the problem would be they wouldn't be voting in the state race.
Right. So federal and state deadlines were not matching up in the least.
Yep, exactly.
What did county clerks say to this?
So county clerks were pretty upset about it. Here in Dane County, the Madison City clerk, Meredith Wetzel Bell, said that she feared that this would reduce the number of votes in the presidential preference or the Supreme Court elections, simply out of voter confusion, because some voters could mark one ballot, maybe voting in the presidential race, and then when they get that second ballot, they could see that it has the presidential race and also the state races, and they could, maybe out of fear that, because you can be prosecuted in the state for voting twice in an election, maybe fearing that they shouldn't fill out that B ballot with the presidential race when in fact they should. And so the clerks in that case would only count the second B ballot with that full race if they had returned it. And so their vote in the presidential race wouldn't have been counted. Or in another case, they could have only returned the B ballot and, maybe only filled out the state candidates. I mean, there's just a lot of different scenarios where they could return one or the other or not fill the whole e-ballot out.
Lots of confusion.
A lot of problems.
Sure. Talking with Riley Vedderkin, government and politics reporter for the Wisconsin State Journal, and we're talking about voting absentee in the presidential primary and the decision not to send out two ballots. So, Riley, what is the alternate plan here that the State Elections Commission came up with? What will they do instead?
So it's interesting. Earlier this week at their meeting, they essentially acknowledged that this law has been on the books since 2011, but they haven't been following it for all absentee voters in past presidential elections since 2011. And they decided to basically ignore what the law says regarding state voters, all state absentee voters, and proceed as they always have been. Which means that absentee voters will only be getting one ballot, with the exception of military and overseas voters, which will be getting two ballots because there is a federal component of this law, which has a 45-day rule, which will also require the clerks to get out two ballots to them. But that's only maybe several thousand people. Much fewer than the 81,000 that'll be affected, that would have been affected if this would have gone into place. So absentee voters will only be getting one ballot here.
And since officials are deciding to kind of work around the law and it hasn't been enforced evenly in the past, is this something that lawmakers will take up in the future to reform this?
Yeah, I asked Assembly Speaker Robin Voss this question yesterday. And he said, you know, he has to take a bit closer look at this. But if, in fact, this law is not at all workable, he said he would be open to changing that law. You know, legislators aren't going to be in much longer this session. So I would be surprised if they tried to speed this through. But I think, you know, looking into the next session, you know, there's at least a possibility that they might make changes.
Riley, what are the upcoming decisions and votes that you're watching for out of the Wisconsin Elections Commission? What moves are you watching from them?
So I will be watching whether or not they decide to enforce this after 2020. They said that they discovered this in looking at the 7th Congressional District primary. So they want to move forward and not apply the state law to any of the 2020 elections. And so I think this issue will kind of be on the back burner. They just want to prevent the type of chaos that we saw in Iowa last week, or was it a couple weeks ago, with their presidential primary. And so I think we'll be focused on just making sure that the elections in the state have integrity, and that there is as little chaos as possible as we head into some really big elections in the state in next week and in April and in November.
Riley, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Riley Vedderkind is a government and politics reporter for the Wisconsin State Journal. And we've been talking about the Wisconsin Elections Commission this week voting unanimously not to send two ballots out to each absentee voter. Coming up, we have a scientific look at how well face masks are able to prevent the spread of illnesses in the midst of the coronavirus outbreak. We'll be back in just a moment. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, it's The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We will be talking about affordable housing issues in our state, especially in rural areas, with the head of the Wisconsin Housing and Economic Development Authority. Do you live in an apartment complex? Is rent affordable? Is there a high demand for housing where you are? And how competitive is it to find a place to call home? Share your housing challenges, your situation right now at 800-642-1234. But first, Wisconsin health officials continue to plan for more cases of coronavirus. It's now called COVID-19. Yesterday marked 2 weeks since a Dane County resident was evaluated and tested at UW Hospital's emergency room before starting isolation at home. Officials with the state public health department say the risk of being infected with COVID-19 is low. But will wearing a face mask give protection? Our colleagues at WisconText have been reporting on medical face masks, looking at whether they work, who should wear them, under what circumstances. Will Cushman is associate editor of WisconText, and he talked with WPR host Keely Baltina.
First of all, yes or no question, do we need face masks to protect us from the novel coronavirus?
According to the World Health Organization and the CDC, the answer in most cases is no. You do not need a face mask to protect yourself against the novel coronavirus.
Then why do we see pictures of people wearing face masks, especially in China?
Sure. There are, in the World Health Organization's guidelines, they do acknowledge that there are cultural differences in the use of face masks to prevent infectious diseases. Depending on where you are in the world, those cultural practices might be different.
But the World Health Organization says physically it does not protect you from the virus.
If you're not sick and in public settings, yeah, they say it's not really, there isn't scientific evidence to support wearing a face mask.
Electronics giant Foxconn actually switched part of its production in China to making surgical masks. So clearly Foxconn thinks that there's demand there. Do we know if we're seeing more people here in Wisconsin buy face masks?
We are. I mean, at least anecdotally, we've noticed a few Walgreens stores in Madison have been sold out at various times, sold out of face masks. And I talked to Walgreens corporate PR people who said that they are seeing rising demand. They didn't say necessarily where, but kind of like across the board, there is a rise in demand for face masks worldwide.
We often see face masks at the doctor's office, at clinics. They're at the beginning when you walk in so that if people are sick, they can put them on. What could a spike on the consumer side of demand mean for the healthcare industry?
Some healthcare professionals are concerned about this demand or this spike in demand reducing the flow of very needed face masks in healthcare settings. So face masks for healthcare workers who are working with people, treating people who have infectious diseases and don't want to catch those, not only the novel coronavirus, but influenza and other infectious diseases. And then also masks for people who are sick, who need them sometimes to help them prevent the spread of whatever disease they're dealing with.
Do we know if certain masks are better at protecting certain kinds of viruses?
There are masks that are better at generally protecting against infectious diseases. I'm not sure about specific viruses, but there's a mask called an N95 mask. It's actually a respirator, essentially, and that has a very tight seal. It fits very tightly around your face versus like a typical surgical mask, which is kind of loose around your face. The N95 masks or respirators are generally only recommended for healthcare workers. In fact, I spoke with an official at UW Hospitals here in Madison, and she said that their staff have to like undergo training to use an N95 mask and to make sure that they're able to handle it because it is quite uncomfortable to wear, especially for long periods of time.
And that seems to play into this, the fact that you spoke to a medical official who said there are three things to think about when you're deciding whether to wear a face mask. And one of them is what kind of face mask you might need and based on what's out there.
Right. Yep. So the N95 masks are recommended for healthcare workers who are working with treating someone who has an unknown infectious disease. Surgical masks are recommended for folks who have respiratory symptoms, coughing, sneezing, And then maybe also a fever, and they're not sure what those symptoms are related to. They haven't been diagnosed with a specific disease yet. So they'll often be asked, especially right now with all the unknowns around the novel coronavirus, to wear a face mask at the doctor's office just to help prevent the spread of droplets, respiratory droplets, which is what diseases like influenza and we think novel coronavirus spread.
And you actually touched on another element of those three that the medical official laid out, which is, you know, you have to think about what's important when it comes to who's wearing the mask.
Yes, yes. So it's definitely masks are not generally recommended for people, asymptomatic people, so people who are healthy, who feel healthy, especially in public settings. Even if you're going to a doctor's office and you're healthy, they probably will not recommend that you wear a face mask right now, just because there isn't the scientific evidence to support that it really helps you not catch a disease.
And so that's the third element, the setting, figuring out the environment in which you will be and if you really need it to protect yourself or to protect others.
Exactly. Yeah. So in a healthcare setting, if you are showing respiratory symptoms, you probably will be asked to wear or likely will be asked to wear a mask. And that is to protect usually the healthcare workers who are treating you, because you are in a close setting. They'll be examining you and you'll be within just a foot or two of each other. So it's when you're in those kind of like close contact settings is when face masks are more recommended.
Will Cushman is the associate editor of WisContext, and we're talking to him about his reporting about face masks and the novel coronavirus. And, well, we should point out we are using the phrase novel coronavirus because that's what's familiar to us right now. But the virus actually now has a more specific name that you use in your WisContext article.
It was originally being called the 2019-CoV virus, which is
A mouthful
uh-huh. For the radio, yeah. But now the World Health Organization has designated the virus SARS-CoV-2, and then the disease that it causes as COVID, so that's COVID-19 for 2019, which is the year that it arose.
So a different name for the virus itself and then a name for the disease that people can experience when they're infected with the virus.
Exactly. And we're not sure if those names may change again.
Certainly, as we see this develop and change and spread or even eventually get a handle on it for sure.
Totally.
Back to masks. Sometimes we see branded fashion masks from time to time. How effective are those? Do they come with other risks?
The healthcare official I spoke to was really not into fashion face masks or reusable face masks in general.
Because you think, well, it's more sustainable, right? To be able to wash something instead of throwing it out.
Sure. Yeah. Yep. So that could be a reason why people might want to buy one of those. Also, because if you buy one face mask, you don't have to keep buying more and more disposable ones. So it could potentially be cheaper in the long term as well. The problem with those reusable face masks is that they're incredibly difficult to clean. Even if you run them through the laundry, like you're not guaranteed that they're going to be free of pathogens. And most people are not super fastidious or at least as fastidious as they need to be when they're cleaning things like their clothes. And so really the face mask can be more problematic and actually cause you to potentially catch a disease, whether it's an infectious disease or something from bacteria, rather than like protecting you against diseases.
So no fashion face masks, even not necessarily face masks if you don't have symptoms. So what kind of things do people do to protect themselves?
The number one recommendation right now is, I think people have heard it year after year, to protect yourself against the common cold and influenza is to wash your hands. So with warm water and soap, sing happy birthday to yourself or sing the ABCs to yourself, and that should be about long enough. Otherwise, social distancing is something that people can do if they're really concerned about catching a disease, especially if you're immunocompromised. So keeping yourself out of public settings, places where a lot of people mix is also a good idea.
And we just learned that UW-Madison plans to do research on the novel coronavirus. Give us a glimpse into what you know about that.
Correct. Yeah, there are a few researchers at UW-Madison who are going to be looking at how the novel coronavirus spreads between, like, how the mechanisms by which it spreads. And they also want to develop or understand, identify, like a good animal model for modeling how the disease works in humans. So right now there isn't an animal model for understanding those effects. And they're actually using a sample of the virus from the patient in Dane County who was confirmed to have the virus last week.
So we're at the very beginning stages of that research here in Wisconsin.
Correct.
All right. Well, thank you for your time today.
Thanks so much.
And that was Will Cushman, the associate editor of WisConText, talking with WPR host Keely Baltina. Coming up, housing challenges in rural Wisconsin are preventing manufacturers from attracting a labor pool. And housing stock, it's very old. We talk with the head of the Wisconsin Housing and Economic Development Authority, Joaquin Altoro. How do you think the state should be expanding access to affordable housing? What initiatives would you support? Phone lines are open, 800-642-1234. Let's talk about housing and your situation, 800-642-1234. That's coming up right after this news update here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about housing challenges on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Housing shortages are affecting our labor pool around the state, and there are a variety of issues in play. Rising construction costs, developers not into doing smaller-scale projects in rural areas, and few affordable rental options. Where do you live? What is your housing situation? Do you live near your work, or do you have a long commute expressly because of your housing? Join in with questions, insights, 800-642-1234. Joaquin Altoro is CEO of the Wisconsin Housing and Economic Development Authority, also known as WEDA. It is a public corporation governed by a 12-member board that includes six appointees of the governor and four legislators representing both parties and both houses. He was confirmed as a cabinet secretary last month. Secretary Altoro, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Kate. How are you doing this lovely morning?
I'm doing well. Let's look at some mechanics first. The authority, WEDA, is not a state agency. Your operating budget and staffing not included in the state budget, but you serve in the governor's cabinet. So how do you work with the governor's priorities on housing as an independent authority?
I very much do appreciate the governor appointing me to this position. And at the same time, I very much appreciate the confirmation by our state Senate. The governor was very clear at the fact that when he had first appointed me of what was really important to him. I'd say first and foremost is that he also was clear at the fact that he knew that he was bringing in, I to really lead this organization with kind of the experience and expertise that I had and to really allow for the autonomy and the challenges that we have around housing. Excuse me. However, rural communities obviously was very, very important to him. And he did also mention our urban communities, and they both have a very unique set of challenges. So I being very excited in leading this organization, I really took some of my time to really understand WEDA first and foremost as to its capacity and what it's produced thus far. And it's an amazing machine that has really had significant impact in the state of Wisconsin.
Right. This authority was originally created nearly a half century ago to provide safe and affordable housing for low to moderate income Wisconsinites. How have the state's strategies in addressing affordable housing needs changed over the decades?
Yeah, that's That's a great question. You know, what we're seeing right now is outside of Wisconsin, states that have had high density and have had really issues around affordability of housing, they're dealing with significant issues on how to get housing out for their unique set of challenges. In Wisconsin, we have ourselves our unique challenges. And when we think about the different communities that we have, let's start with our rural communities. We hear about the challenges happening with kind of poverty. And what we see is in our area median income in these communities is that poverty is increasing. Along with that, obviously, that has a direct tie to housing. And so what we're seeing right now, and especially as communities are taking ownership around housing and they're doing their studies, is that there is a need. We see in rural communities that our populations are getting older. We see that some of our youth are moving out of rural communities and headed to the urban communities. And because of that, what we need to really do as a state is really begin to understand some of the data that's coming out of these studies and really take our time to figure out how do we leverage either the lending, the tax credits, and kind of the renewed and reinvigorated kind of excitement and interest around housing in the state.
You've been hosting some listening sessions around the state. What are you hearing from residents about their housing needs?
It does really change from community to community. I'll tell you, we do have communities where we have, because of years of strong economic growth, we have employers that are very clear about the fact that, as you know, as challenge number one about them recruiting and retaining and workforce is the fact that housing is a really important part of that whole spectrum of making sure that they are successful in contributing to their immediate community. We just yesterday, I've heard from a community at the fact that, like I just mentioned right now, that the housing stock is getting older, that they're...
And when you say older, this is housing mm-hmm. stock from the late 1930s.
Yes, yes. And you could imagine now that if we are trying to recruit and retain a workforce, and sometimes it'll be a younger workforce, are they interested in that older housing stock? So we hear that. Now, when we talk about urban communities, you know, we have a different issue that we're hearing about because of the aggregation of density of people. What we're realizing is that housing has an impact on the health and well-being of people also in urban communities. And so what we're seeing is that because there's such a packing of people into place and space, is that what we're trying to figure out, and we do have examples of that, is where how do we hybridize maybe first of all housing and supportive services for single parents or for behavioral health or for health in general? Or maybe how do we hybridize the conversation of economic development and housing, where a portion of the housing might support commercial corridors on the first floor, or a support of growing that economic development in that area, but at the same time provide housing. There was a project that WEDA supported some years back where it had a library on the first floor, and then on the second floor, some of the units were dedicated to grandparent and grandchildren housing, because we've seen a growth of that, of grandchildren living with their grandparents. So really thinking outside of the box of not just building the four walls, but are we supporting kind of the needs of the community itself?
Does that housing situation still exist today?
I don't understand the question.
Does that library with the specific tenants above it, does that still exist today?
Absolutely. It's the Villard Library in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. It does still exist today. It has affordable units in where the rents are adjusted to the area median income of the area. And yes, it does still exist today.
Talking with Joaquin El Toro, CEO of the Wisconsin Housing and Economic Development Authority, you can join in. Have you secured a loan to purchase your home? What was that process like? What questions do you have about housing and redevelopment in your area? Does housing factor into whether you accept a job or not? Join in at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Let's bring in Mary Kay now, joining us from Kenosha. Hi, Mary Kay.
Good morning. I'd like to talk about WEDA. They already are the contract monitor. But the problem is when the WEAC inspector goes through these apartments and they don't listen to the tenant to make the apartment safer, okay? So the problem here is, you know, that part. Plus, low-income people need to have 30% of their income. And these owners and these corporations and these nonprofits need to maintain these apartments for their inhabitable conditions, okay? And if you would hire the poor Americans for doing the drywall, the painting, the landscaping, you know, people that have been already educated here to do these things, we could have better housing.
Mary Kay, thank you for the call. Joaquin, it sounds as if, you know, tenants need to be understood here in terms of how their housing is being kept up.
Yeah, she touches on two very important subjects. I think, first of all, as WEDA administers tax credits for developers to develop affordable housing units throughout the state of Wisconsin, at the same time, what we do is we have a very stringent process in making sure that we carefully monitor the property management firms that manage these properties. Very, very important. And a majority of those property managers do a great job. But I would tell those that are listening today, and I would continue to tell those, that the process that we have, that we do an amazing job at holding them accountable. We do annual training to the property managed firms because of the fact that not only are we concerned at WEDA about affordable housing, but safe housing. Like, those two things should go together. Safe and affordable housing. I think everyone knows, not I think, I know that everyone in the state of Wisconsin deserves the right for that safe and affordable housing. The other issue she touched on, which is, you know, something that I'm hearing a lot from communities around the fact that how in the world, what are some of, you started with that question around the fact of what are some of the issues around getting, building affordable housing in rural communities. And we sit in an amazing time right now, and I think this is an unfortunate aspect of it, is that one of the things we can't control is maybe the rising cost of construction. But workforce recruitment of people into construction and being able to build these buildings, attracting developers into rural communities has been very difficult.
Why is that?
You know, I think, first of all, is that we see rural communities sometimes when they have an opportunity, it is maybe 20, 30, 40 units, where we could see almost 10 times that amount in urban communities. And developers have not been flocking to that type of an opportunity. And at the same time, like I had mentioned, them finding the workers to do the projects out in rural communities has been difficult. But what we're trying to do at WEDA is really be a part of a new process of engagement at WEDA. In the past, the way that we are business and community engagement officers, we'd go out into communities and just talk about the products that we have. But today, what we want to do is be a part of a participant. We want to be a participant in the conversation to really talk about how are communities taking ownership around this conversation of housing, and what kind of programs are they creating to attract workers and maybe to train workers around construction.
We're looking at the housing situation in Wisconsin with Joaquin El Toro, CEO of the Wisconsin Housing and Economic Development Authority. WEDA administers loan programs and other projects that provide housing and related assistance to Wisconsinites. Have you obtained a loan to buy your home? Have you found it difficult to secure affordable housing? How much of your take-home pay goes toward housing? Join in 800-642-1234. Back in a moment with more here on the Ideas Network. We're looking at the housing situation in Wisconsin here on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Nearly a month ago, the state Senate confirmed Joaquin El Toro as CEO of the Wisconsin Housing and Economic Development Authority, or WEDA. The authority reported total assets of $2.8 billion for fiscal year 2019, much of its portfolio in single-family, multifamily, and other loans and mortgage-backed securities. El Toro's background is in residential and commercial lending. What do you want to know about how the housing authority works? What is the biggest housing challenge in your community? Still time for you, 800-642-1234. And WEDA Executive Director Joaquin El Toro stays with us. Let's go back to the phones now. Mary is joining us from La Crosse. Hi, Mary.
Hi, thank you. The problem that I'm seeing here in La Crosse is a lack of modest apartments. The apartment I live in now was built with WEDA money, and 2 years ago it was sold to other investors, and so we will not be under WEDA in two more years. And most of us are widows, single people, and we have modest, lovely apartments with garages, and trying to find other apartments now that are affordable is really difficult. And I know that WEDA doesn't develop, but all of the apartments being built in the area now are these big apartment developments with wonderful amenities, and they're wonderful, but they're very expensive. And so those of us who are losing this WEDA advantage are at a disadvantage now, trying to find something affordable.
Mary, do you suspect that you will need to move?
Absolutely.
Joaquin El Toro, what is the situation like when a WEDA apartment complex changes hands?
Yeah, you know, this issue that Mary brings up is a very serious issue. And what we call that is preservation of affordability. You know, what we do right now is, as a part of the tax credit program, we have ourselves a 30-year affordability period. And that obviously has an end point and an end time that could affect residents in this exact manner. And so as a part of us really thinking differently at WEDA as a protecting and preserving affordability, what we're trying to really do is figure out, as we work with communities. So WEDA, the tax credits that we provide is a limited resource, and it only builds so many properties. And so when we engage with communities nowadays, like La Crosse, and have conversations with them as to what their priorities are, we want to make sure that we help them in working and understanding that preservation is a really important thing. One thing that I've noticed in speaking with developers, I would say first is that in the state of Wisconsin, probably in the last 10 years, is a majority of new apartment development has been market rate. But now, speaking to developers that have been working in the market rate area, we're realizing that they understand that there is a duty to them to understanding how affordability comes into play as a part of the diversity of housing. So even developers are starting to think a little bit different as to should they preserve, if they have that a part of their portfolio is all market renting, how can they create new units that obviously are affordable? But I think it's a really important conversation. And at WEDA, what we're trying to do is, as a part of new units, obviously, is make sure that we are that we've created the rules that are going to protect the affordability for a long time. But at the same time, we want to continue to be a part of the conversation of preserving affordability going forward.
Your agency is also responsible for issuing bonds, housing revenue bonds, to help finance rental housing developments. Which areas in the state are in need of more rental housing developments, and where these bonds go?
So in general terms, WEDA uses its bond authority to offer favorable loan interest rates and terms to construct, rehabilitate, and preserve affordable housing. So, you know, we leverage our housing tax credits and our low-cost financing to help expand affordable rental housing for Wisconsin workers, families, and seniors. And so with that, the way that it is directed is when we have communities and or developers that submit applications for the tax credits, that kind of informs the way and where we use our bonding, because, you know, the bonding creates kind of the cash resource that we're able to put out in the market. So it really comes directly from the communities and the developers when they submit their applications to WIDA.
Talking with Joaquin Altoro, CEO of the Wisconsin Housing and Economic Development Authority. Let's go back to the phones. Jeremy is with us from Racine. Good morning, Jeremy.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. A few years back, my wife and I were looking at purchasing a home up north in more rural Wisconsin, and we came across a lot of difficulties that we weren't willing to contend with. One, when you're purchasing a home in a rural area, you have to contend with other amenities like LP gas resupply, well water, maintaining that, as well as septic tanks and things. And the housing price wasn't really that much different than in an urban. The prices were still just as high. Houses are still old. And then you had other things to contend with in regards to healthcare services, emergency services, and things like that that just didn't make it really, you know, appealing to my wife and I to make that jump over into the northern Wisconsin area. It's just we seem to have a much better option down here in the south, more densely populated areas because of those amenities and things like that we don't have to contend with.
So, Jeremy, it sounds as if, Jeremy, you wanted a more rural life, but when you looked at what the options were there and the amenities around you, it just didn't add up. Joaquin Altoro, what do you hear in Jeremy's situation?
Yeah, there's an absolute reality. It's like access in living in a rural community, access to health, access to transportation, access to so many things is and has been difficult for some time. And the communities that we speak to right now are very aware of that. One of the things that WIDA is trying to do as it pertains to housing is for many years now, WIDA has been kind of a resource for property managers, for developers, and kind of the practitioners around housing. But what we realize is that one of the ways that we could provide quality information to these communities is to work better and closer with municipalities. So what we're trying to do as a part of our engagement is, first and foremost, we have an annual conference. And with this conference, what we want to do is kind of have a higher concentration in inviting municipalities to come to the table and have conversations so that we can bring in state case studies as to how our communities throughout the United States building 20, 30, 40 units. What type of zoning is necessary? What type of staffing is needed at the city? If we were to build a multifamily unit, should we maybe have the space that's on the first floor, should that be maybe a clinic so that it's closer to these units? And so we're really excited at the fact that there has been a change at WIDA and the way we're engaging and really trying to be able to provide this real quality information to the municipalities, again, as it pertains to housing and how it really engages the community.
Before we let you go, your grandfather came to Milwaukee from Mexico in the early 1900s, and he was the start of growth of Latinos in Milwaukee. How do you see your own work through what your grandfather did?
Yeah, it's that's a great question. My grandfather did come in the early 1900s to work at the Pfister and Vogel Tannery in Walker's Point in Milwaukee. And as his family grew, and as the family grew, he had 17 kids, so I had 17 aunts and uncles. As the family grew here in Milwaukee, I think it was interesting to see how they engaged with a community, how they gave back to the community, how they either started businesses, where they wanted to live, where they wanted to spend money, how they built community. And that's kind of informed me as a banker over all these years, is that I have to really be a real good banker. Now the leader at WIDA, I can't just know about one topic, i.e. housing. I really have to be a mini expert on all the things that make up kind of the stew of a healthy community, and make sure that I understand how does that click back into the conversation of housing. And so I really do appreciate the fact that as I saw my family grow here in Milwaukee, now that I go into communities that might be majority, if they're very, if there's a younger community, if there's an older age community, whatever that case is, I'm trying to be respectful of how all the things that affect them, that I understand that and how that
and
impacts.
We have to go here, Joaquin El Toro, here on the Ideas Network.